you're going to hear some familiar themes, some echoes from what Cliff is doing. He's talking about in practice what journals have made and societies have made the decision to do. And I'm going to go back to the scientists' perspective and look and see what individual scientists, scientists worldwide are telling us, what are their barriers and incentives. And I should mention that this is, I'm looking from the human behavioral side, not the technological side of barriers. So what do people tell us they feel are the barriers, or what do they need to be encouraged to share? And, you know, I think it's interesting that those of us involved in data sharing and data research, data management, we often spend a lot of time trying to convince scientists to share their data because it's good, because it's an obligation, because it's the right thing to do. And sometimes I think that perhaps we use the wrong words when we talk about sharing, or send. Sometimes we send the wrong message. Sometimes this idea of sharing is a dirty word. I give my data, I put my data, but I don't necessarily get anything in return. Sharing my data means a little bit about losing control, and we heard about some of that before, that, you know, I don't know what other people are going to be doing. I'm giving it, I'm not sure what's going to happen, and perhaps, again, not getting anything in return. So rather than sharing, I think we need to think about this idea of reciprocity. The very first survey that we did of sharing, we had this idea came from the comments. People said, sharing, what do you mean that I have to share? This idea that it should be a reciprocal kind of process. Using arguments or emphasis of what you get in return by preserving, by depositing your data into central repositories, the idea of data that will be there for you to use and reuse, and others to use and reuse into the future. After you're retired, after you're gone, the data will be preserved and available. But also the idea of reciprocity has something to do with, Cliff mentioned, the idea of increased accessibility to your data, increased citations to your work, to your articles that come out of the data, as well as citations to the data itself, and identify perhaps potential collaborators. Maybe it's co-authors, or maybe it's collaborators in future studies. And the idea of reuse by others of data, the potential reciprocity or potential benefits to the data original share, in terms of better science, increased efficiencies, et cetera. So the idea that you give or you share, but you also get something in return. And so today I'm going to talk a lot about these perceived barriers and data sharing incentives, again with the focus on what scientists tell us are their key concerns and the key motivators to sharing, and some of the things we've heard before, but I'll kind of give the bigger picture. Most talks about data sharing start with something about the data lifecycle. There are many, many data lifecycles out there. This happens to be the data one data lifecycle, with the idea that the process of data starts with a data management plan that guides the collection of data, the quality assurance, the description of data and preservation, discovery, et cetera, and use and analysis and use. A lot of researchers, however, skip that bottom part, focusing on planning, collecting, assuring, using, analyzing, reusing, and continuing. But the idea of describing through good metadata, preserving by deposit into a data repository, providing systems that allow discovery and rediscovery by others, integrating with other data sets, has really not been a part of the workflow of a lot of sciences. And of course, this is where data management and data managers fit in to kind of complete that cycle, so that there's at least an awareness, I guess I would say, of the rest of those processes. Even if each scientist, him or herself, is not doing all of those steps themselves, and I think that's kind of an important thing we need to talk about. How much does an individual scientist who's involved in planning, collecting, assuring, analyzing, using, how much do they need to be, do they have to be involved in the actual steps of describing preserving and providing systems to discover, and how much can they, instead their awareness of it, can they work with others to make that happen. So I'm going to talk about both of those. The presentations or the surveys that I'm talking about today are part of the Data One assessment of stakeholders. I'm co-lead of the Usability and Assessment Working Group of Data One, and one of our challenges and one of the things that we are asked to do is do periodic assessments of a variety of stakeholders. Scientists, which I'm talking about today, are our key stakeholder group. We've done an international assessment of data sharing practices and barriers and incentives twice now, one in 2010-11, one in 14-15, and I'm going to talk about those. We have another one planned for 16-17, so there's this idea of looking at things over time. I'd also be glad to answer questions about the libraries and librarians. Somebody brought that up earlier. We have conducted two libraries and librarians survey, so I can look at those changes over time, and also educators or we've looked at academic educators and data managers as well. So I'd be glad to answer questions about any of those, but the focus here is going to be on the scientists' assessments. The assessments, as I said, are international. From the 2010-11 and the 2014-15, we've had over 1,000 responses from all over the world. The bulk of the responses are from North America, 61% this time from North America. That's actually down slightly from the 2010-11, and then spread out over the rest of the world. The other third, a little more than a third. Our respondents range in age. We've got the biggest group is the group that's the younger scientists, if you will, and three quarters are scientists who are in the under 50 age group. So it's a slightly younger group than the average academic group, and three quarters of them are in the academic work sector. So we do have scientists who work in government and commercial, not for profit, but the bulk of what I'm telling you about today are from academic scientists. So just to go right into the findings about data, we find, and this was true in the 10-11, that most tell us they are willing to share at least some of their data. When we ask how much of your data would you make available to others, that biggest group is some. 43% said I'd make some of my data, and then the most is the green. So most or some, most say, but there's a big difference between sharing some of my data, most of my data, and sharing all of my data. And there, again, a recognition of some data I don't want to share for whatever reasons, but I'm willing to share most or at least some of my data. And that goes to the idea some is different from all when you ask about sharing in repositories. So the first question is, are you willing to share your data, however you do that? The second is, are you willing to place your data into central data repositories? And almost twice as many say that they're willing to place at least some of the data into a central repository than those who say they're willing to place all of their data. Okay, it is not an absolute black and white world. Someone shouldn't be told that every bit of the data needs to be shared. It's the data that perhaps is most important, or they feel most comfortable, or they have the rights to do, that can be shared or willing to share. There is still what I would call a gap between willingness to share and accessibility. So we ask a series of statements about level of agreement, and three quarters in 2010-11 and 80% now of scientists agree or strongly agree with the statement, I share my data. However, a much smaller group say that others can access my data easily. And this is what I call the gap. Because, yeah, if you ask me, I'll share my data, or at least some of my data, perhaps not all. But can people get to it easily? No. There are barriers either because the systems are there or because I want you to have to come through me. So this gap is perhaps narrowing a bit. If you look at the numbers from the earlier survey and this survey, it does seem to be that the gap is perhaps narrowing, but it is still there. That yes, I'll share my data, but it's not so easy. It's not so easy for people to get to it. So data managers spend a lot of time trying to make that gap even narrower, to make it easier to get to share data, but also to access data for use and reuse. Most of our respondents in both surveys agree in principle with the ideas of data sharing or data reuse. So almost 90% now say they would use others' data sets if the data were easily acceptable. So that, you know, in principle, I would use others' data sets. They're also willing to share their data across a broad group of researchers, again, almost 90%. And a vast majority agree it's appropriate to create new data sets from shared data. So a lot of these things we hear as potential barriers, it looks, again, at least from the idea of the principle of it, that most say, well, it is now appropriate, and I would be willing to use others. But, and here's the big but, some conditions must be met, and data repositories, people who are involved in data management really need to be aware of conditions that need to be met. You heard a lot from Cliff about data citation, data acknowledgement. Absolutely essential. It was essential in 2010. It's essential now that if my data is available, I want to get formal citation credit, that my data needs to be cited. You know, that's overwhelming. I need to get acknowledgement as well, acknowledgement of the funder of my data collection and acknowledgement of me as the provider. So no question about that, and that remains really strong. Some of the other things are decreasing slightly perhaps now. The opportunity to collaborate is still quite strong and still a big motivator in terms of overcoming barriers. The idea of demanding reciprocal sharing agreements or demanding or getting reprints of articles or complete lists of products that use your data, still more than half agree that would be a good kind of incentive or condition for placing their data in a data repository, but those numbers are decreasing. And I don't know this, but one of the questions that came up earlier, do repositories at least give you numbers of people that are downloading your data or looking at your data, or in fact information about who is doing that? Number of repositories do that now, and perhaps that may be one reason why these are decreasing, because they're getting that information now from data that's shared. Don't know. But anyway, the demand for that still relatively high, but decreasing somewhat. But people want to have credit for their work. So that goes right into the idea of barriers for not making data available. This is in order from the 2014 survey of what are the barriers. The very first one is something that was debunked as a myth in the last talk, that this idea of being scooped. But the number one incentive choice, people could choose more than one, but the number one incentive or barrier for not making is I want to publish first. I need to publish first. And again, remember the group that we looked at tend to be skewed to younger scientists, and the idea that I need to publish my work before my data is shared. Some of the other things that have recurred in both studies, there are some perhaps solutions, I guess I would say, to some of these others. Insufficient time, lack of funding, insufficient skills, you see those scattered throughout here. These are things that when I talk about perhaps the scientist doesn't have to do the whole data life cycle, his or herself. There could be collaborative solutions, which I'll talk about in a little bit. I don't have time to do it. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what to do. These are kinds of things that we need to work together to find some solutions. And a variety of other things. Didn't make the top list the idea of others may misinterpret my data. It was a choice, and some people did mention it. I think it comes up more in certain fields than others. I went to a meeting of the American Psychological Association, where it was a huge concern even 10 years ago, the idea of misinterpreting data. It comes in when there's human subjects data, for sure, but not just that. The idea that if someone has a political agenda, perhaps they might misinterpret data. But in the this is mostly scientists and life scientists, and it did not come out as that top, in that top list of barriers to making data available. So I want to finish my talk and then leave some time for discussion and questions too, by talking a little bit about how can some of these barriers be overcome. And some of them have to do with our surveys, for example, of educators and of librarians. The first solution or potential solution to a lot of those barriers have to do with flexible conditions or flexible system design and data repositories. That is things like that Dryad does, for example, that links to and from published articles. So that barrier of I need to publish first. Data repositories that provide a link that can be put in an article, a link to the data, and then the article can be linked to the data set. So we have this reciprocal kind of linking, and linking that can occur after the first publication. That increases citations as well as allows somebody to have a publication first and then make the data available for subsequent use and reuse by others. So that's a kind of solution to that barrier. Another solution, system kind of solution, is something that Cliff mentioned, as metadata-only exposure. The idea that if there is sensitive data or data that should not be made available or don't have the rights to be made available, at least it can be preserved in a dark archive kind of setting with metadata exposure, or an embargo that once I've published my article, or within a year or within a certain time, the data can be made available. It's another way to have the benefit of preservation and some level of transparency, but recognizing the human sort of barrier that may exist. And then the last kind of flexible condition for data repositories are access controls. There, again, some sensitive data that there needs to be a control over, perhaps who is accessing it. Repositories have a process where the person can see the metadata. If they want to get access to sensitive data, then they have to be vetted or approved either by the author, but more likely by the repository. And so this is a solution. I'm not saying that all repositories should have these kinds of restrictions. I think the ideal world is an immediate open data solution, but in response to human needs and perceived barriers, these are kinds of easy sorts of solutions that reassure people, that allow flexibility and have the ideal of preservation and exposure of data before it gets lost, and so people know what's there, kind of a halfway solution, if you will. And a number of professional societies or funding agencies in particular now and journals are beginning to demand a data repository, but very often they allow this kind of embargo or they allow a kind of condition to be set. And so this often will meet the funder's requirements as well. A second kind of solution or of barriers or incentives are collaboration and assistance. So remember those barriers of I don't have enough time, I don't have the skills to do it, I don't have the money to spend time describing my data, getting it ready for deposit, et cetera. This is the area where working with libraries, working with data managers and others, this kind of collaborative work can really help. A scientist's main duty is, a main job is to get the work done to make new discoveries. It is not necessarily in their minds to worry about what metadata schema they're going to use or to provide access into the future. We need to get that awareness, but there needs to be assistance. So this is where Association of Research Libraries has been, ARL in the U.S. and Canada has been doing quite a bit in this area. A number of European libraries are also involved, and of course in government agencies and others, the growth of data managers who really the job is to provide assistance to those who don't have time or expertise or funds to do it themselves. And an example here of a collaborative group, not at the preservation area, but at the very start of the data life cycle, at the data, at the plan, the data management plan, is the collaborative data management plan, the DMP tool that was developed primarily by the California Digital Library, but with lots and lots of assistants and partners and collaborators. And any scientist now can use the DMP tool to help them create a data management plan according to their funding agency, and it doesn't require every researcher to come start from scratch and writing a data management plan, or every institution from start to scratch. So these kind of collaborative solutions are really very, very helpful in overcoming barriers. And then the last sort of overcoming of the barriers, or ways to help overcome those barriers, is through better education. I was a bit surprised is the right word, maybe chagrined or disappointed. In our last scientist survey, we had one question that asked, are you teaching at the undergraduate, graduate, or any other level data management processes? And it was just over 10% that said yes, they were. So of the respondents, it's still a very small percent. And then we got into a lot of detailed questions for those. But better education, better tools, better awareness, and all of these kinds of things are necessary. That's part of any of you who are in an educational environment, part of the undergraduate and graduate education. But it also can be part of what libraries and data managers do. And I refer you to the Data One education modules, marvelous modules. Stephanie was involved in the development of these at the beginning, and they're continually to be evolved and to be improved, and that's a way to get really kind of an easy way. Not everybody has to develop all of this by themselves. It's a good way to raise awareness about a variety of issues. And one example that gets repeated quite a bit that I should mention in terms of education, when in the surveys, both the 2010 and 2014 surveys, when we ask what metadata standard do you use to describe your data, the number one choice, would you guess? None. Yeah. So not surprising, but still, again, disappointing. So it's probably, I suspect a number of them say none, are like, I'm not even sure what that is or what standards there are or what I should be using. By the way, the long tail, so none is huge, but the tail is so long. So when does a standard not become a standard? When there are so many, you know, when there are hundreds to choose from, and people are confused. So education can help in this is one way to help. In your field, what is the standard you should be using, or in the repository that you are that makes sense for you to deposit your data. So just in conclusion, and I'm leaving these up here because both of the scientist surveys are available, have been published in Plus One, and the other surveys are also either published or in peer review right now. But in conclusion, there are a lot of psychological, if you will, or human behavioral barriers to overcome in data sharing. I think we're early still in the process in most fields, not every field. Certainly NASA and a variety of fields have had early adopters there, but in most fields it's fairly a new conversation. And so, but overcoming, there are identifiable barriers, but there are some identifiable incentives as well. So certainly giving people credit for preserving, describing, making their data available, yes, it's sharing, but it's also reciprocal. You get credit, you get potential collaborators, you get increased use, you get better science is the ultimate of that, but there's also things that help in the career. Changing the academic reward system so that publishing in a data journal or making your data available and citations to your data become part of the academic reward system is another way to help incentives and help overcome some of those barriers. And then again, there are system solutions, realizing that it's not an all or one kind of process that, or that there doesn't have, there can be embargoes. Sometimes those seem like dirty words, but it's still, there can be some acknowledgement, some recognition that not all data can be shared, but let's get some or most available, and that's a good place to start. Thank you.
Do we have any questions, Kyle?
I really appreciated your comment and your little picture on sharing with the little kids. In your survey, did you ask people if they thought they owned their data?
You know, we didn't. It, in a sense, it's implied when we say your data. But we did, yeah. But we did ask the question. One of the choices of why I don't share my data is I don't have the rights. So in a sense, that was the number three. That's only 18% though that selected that. But I don't have the rights to share the data. So in that sense, that's probably acknowledgement that they think perhaps they don't own the data. But we didn't explicitly say, you know, do you own your data? I suspect the answer is most of them believe it is their data or their research team's data or their collaborators' data, but we didn't explicitly say. Do you have a reason for asking?
Well, just because I think there is this very strong sense of ownership, which we do not have necessarily for papers.
Yeah.
Somebody says to me, will you share your paper? Yeah, sure, it's published. I don't own it anymore, really.
Yeah.
It has things like copyrights from the journal on it, and maybe your institution has retained some ownership or whatever.
Yeah.
But yet we seem not to have that sense that our data, you know, for our data, we seem to think it's very close. It is literally ours, much the way an artist who paints a picture has the ownership of that picture. But it's not, most of us are operating under contract.
Well, it's interesting, and some of the open-ended comments I think speak to that, which I didn't bring in. We haven't done a lot of analysis with our open-ended comments, but we have thousands, and but part of that, people say this is my career, so data is something that they're going to live with perhaps for, you know, 30, 40 years. It is my career, and so the hesitation of sharing is somebody may. This myth perhaps of undermining my career, whereas an article is an output of my career. The data is something I'm going to continue to build on. The outputs are things I'm measured on. So that sort of implies that feeling as well. Yeah. Yeah, in the back you had first.
No, really, I think you're really touching on an poorly understood part of the big data issue. It really is a challenge.
Yeah.
One thing that would help me understand your results would be, how do you define the concept of data? Because for some people, you know, if you're doing lab work and you're doing replicates of the same sample in the lab, triplicate, and curves, repeats,
yeah.
We've been told by some data specialists that that's the data. You ask some researchers, they'll say, no, the data is the sum of that averaged, you know, and so what is, you know, and people wouldn't want to necessarily publish that grisly, very granular stuff out of the lab. So when you talk about data, when you survey about data, how do you define?
Yeah, so part of that is we leave up to the person analyzing, but we do tend to say data or data sets. And of course, you know, a data set may be that next stage where you've described something and done something to it. But we do say research data collected in, you know, for your work. We do give them the data life cycle, talk about that, especially when we're talking about do you do any education on any part of this data life cycle. The other part is we do, and I haven't done a lot of analysis looking at that, is we do give a list of choices of what kind of data. So we would be able to look at the kind of data they're looking at and their results to see if they're different. So in that case, it tends to be more, you know, survey data, not so much what you're saying, but we ask about, you know, biotic surveys, abiotic surveys, data, human subject survey data, those kinds of things. So we do ask people to define it from that perspective. What kind of data are you? But we haven't, there hasn't, as I say, we haven't done a lot of analysis, but the data sets are available in Dryad if anybody would like to look at and look a little further than that. But you're right, how an individual defines data could be quite distinct. There are, of course, huge differences in subject discipline. Now, within a subject discipline, there can be different kinds of data, too. But if we look at our results by subject discipline overall, some disciplines are much more likely or willing or amenable to the idea of data sharing than other subject disciplines. But that doesn't get quite down to the granularity you're interested to. But if I put the subject discipline together with the kind of data, we might be able to get there. And we have those data in the data set. Yes. Stephanie, are you going to get into that at all? I don't want to, the individual stories a little bit.
Yeah.
So I know you'll hear more of that. There have been some institutional stories from the library side. So the research libraries that are involved in promoting more data management in their organization. So in those cases, the really successful ones tend to be research libraries. So the Association of Research Libraries is 120 biggest in terms of funding libraries in Canada and the U.S., and so it's a subset of those. And they are ones that the successful ones tend to not do it just alone. So it's maybe a library-led coalition with the Office of Research at a university and certain scientists or departments that are particularly open to data sharing. For example, it might be environmental sciences or evolutionary biology or some of the other areas that have. And so it's a collaborative kind of work. And so I think that's one key in terms of a study. Also, this education piece is key. So providing tools for the faculty who are doing teaching within the context of their class. So it's one thing to just give a talk, you know, have a data manager get up there and do something in general, but it seems to be that the successful stories are the ones where they provide materials so a faculty member can have a unit within their course on sound data management practices. Mm-hmm. So it's this kind of incorporating it into the whole workflow and changing the workflow or the work process or the way of thinking across the university or across the campus. So I think those would be the few that are doing that well. The ones that are trying to do it on the south or just kind of impose things, not so much success yet. We're going to be doing European Union, a survey of European Union libraries next year, and they say their institutions are ahead of the U.S. and Canada in terms of research data management because of earlier funder and government mandates for data sharing. So we shall see next year.
Yeah. So obviously, the latent concern of many scientists is that their data will either be abused or abused or just not credited. Are you aware of cases where complaints have arisen, and can you explain how those were dealt with?
I am not. Now, Cliff, you mentioned it as an urban myth, or maybe that was Dave's talk.
Well,
yeah. Couldn't find any examples in environmental sciences of examples. There have been, I mean, in climate, we all know examples, and it's more of a, the examples tend to be less other scientists abusing as it is political agenda. So how they're dealt with is, you know, opening the discussion, but it becomes a politicized discussion. So climate, but also in the psychology community, the concern was about issues on LGBT data that would be misinterpreted, and so it's a matter of pointing out. Now, some of you have probably seen the article recently that Open Science talked about of the psychology data set that was sent to 100 different researchers, and there were at least, to replicate the results, and there were at least, I don't quite remember, but more than 50 different solutions or answers. And part of this is this, and it was reported widely in the media. So getting better at talking to the media is probably the other process of this. But in that case, it's human subjects data, so it's different. It's using statistical analysis, a little different than what we're talking about here. But the idea that you could take 100 different statistical tests and you can get slightly different results depending on which test you choose. But it was not reported that way. It was reported that if you all didn't get the same results, therefore the data must be wrong. And I think we're going to see increased worry about that in sensitive issues, in issues like climate change, issues like psychology, issues where there's sensitive. So how is it dealt with right now? Poorly, I think.